Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I am Ted Santos, and I am your co-host of The Creative Alchemist. And we are the show that addresses your business needs, not just if you're an entrepreneur, and you surely want to be here if you're an entrepreneur, if you're an aspiring entrepreneur, or if you're working in a company and the conversations that we have are relevant to you, your job, or someone in your department. This is the show you'll never want to miss. We are the Creative Alchemist, where we bring creativity and transformation so that you can transform your company to do the things that you like to see it do. I never take this journey alone. I always have a co-host, and we always have a guest. But before we introduce the guest, Lori, let them know you're here.
Hi, it's Lori Miller from LGC Interior Design, and bringing to you every Thursday night our Creative Alchemist, and so excited to have our guest tonight. Valerie's pretty special, and she's somebody everybody wants, because we all could use a little capital. So thank you, Valerie, for coming on the show, and tell us a little bit, I guess, about yourself.
Okay, thank you, Lori. Thank you, Ted. I appreciate the opportunity to introduce myself with regards to capital and, you know, raising capital for companies. I've been in the finance industry for probably about 30 years, and a lot of times when people ask me to tell them a little bit about myself, I always wonder where they want me to start. So one business associate said, well, he wanted me to reverse the question, like, well, what would you like to know? And I thought that was pretty good, because since I've been in finance 30 years, I've evolved from the level of life insurance as a financial planner to corporate finance. So in between there, I was commercial real estate and residential mortgage loan officer. So my background in finance varies. But I found that in dealing with high net worth investors from being in the commercial real estate business, when the market when we entered into the Great Recession in 2008, I converted my interest into corporate finance and came to New York and built relationships in New York City. With people with high net worth that were looking to invest in publicly traded companies. And then I looked at some other avenues, and we started investing in privately held. So I can go on and on. So I think it's like probably best if you ask me some questions and I can answer, because I can give you a vast history of my background in the industry from every angle.
Okay. So if we look at the theme, our theme for the show is how to raise capital on your own terms. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of people, they might think about crowdfunding and they're going to do a GoFundMe, and we hear about all the GoFundMes. And, you know, I would assume that some of those crowdfunding they're beneficial, and there are lots of different terms. Sometimes you give up equity, sometimes you don't. And or you have to give something back to your donors, I'll call them. But you've found a very creative niche that perhaps a lot of entrepreneurs or even your savvy business people may not even be aware of this. So I'm going to put you on the spot. Is the opportunity you have found different from crowdfunding, and in what ways?
I'm glad you asked that, Ted, because crowdfunding, our business, which we just changed the name in a sense, and we didn't really change the name. We created a new name during the pandemic, so we found ways to streamline the process of raising equity capital from accredited investors. Crowdfunding has a maximum amount of capital you can raise, $1,070,000. So our company, Founders Trust Bank, raises unlimited amount of capital because we use Rule 506C. But going back to crowdfunding, the SEC allows one who files a application, I think it's Form CF, I think it's Form C, actually, to apply for crowdfunding, and you take your offering and you list it on a platform. There's probably about 20 or 30 platforms out there associated with broker-dealers in which you can raise capital up to $1 million, and a lot of the offerings may start at as low as $100 because they target unaccredited investors, which those are people who could take a risk of loss because their minimum investment could be $100, maximum might be $1,000. What I found in just observing the crowdfunding platform was some companies get funded fully, and others may get funded maybe 20-30%. So if they get funded 20-30% and they only can stay on the platform for 1 year, that's ineffective for that 12 months. So a lot of companies that do crowdfunding, unless that platform has investors that are active on a basis in which they're fully funding companies on a regular basis, then companies will be successful at $1 million. But you find some companies that they haven't fully funded their crowdfunding. They're offering on a platform. And once you get on a platform, from what I understand, because I don't focus on crowdfunding, but once they're on that platform, they can't come off that platform and look for investors outside that platform. So they couldn't come to me and do a Reg D. Yeah. Yeah, they have to stay in that platform because they have an agreement with the platform for a certain amount of money at the end of the day to be funded, to pay that platform for their offering to be listed on that platform. So if they came out of it, it sort of would be breach of contract to pay an outsider when they already have an agreement with an insider, which is the platform for the crowdfunding. So
okay.
I suggest some companies, based on our exchange, if they wanted to raise $1 million, we would still be able to use the offering just to present the investment to accredited investors in a professional manner. However, we stay focused on Reg D, Rule 506C, which in comparison to Rule 506B, where it states that you can only present your offering to investors that you are familiar with, that know you and you've done business with them. 5C says you could take a private company and market it to the public to raise capital. However, you would have to verify the credit status of each purchaser of that stock or the offering.
Okay. So let's take a step back then. So one of the things with crowdfunding is there's a limit, right? So there's a limit that's slightly over $1.5 million that you can raise, and you're locked into that for 12 months. And if you only get 20 to 50%, and that's the 12 months, that's all you get, right? You're shooting
yep.
for 1.5, and you end up with, you know, $800,000.
Mm-hmm.
That's not good, right? And you're constrained, especially if you have a business that's growing or you're in tough times like our last recession.
Mm-hmm.
So you have found something. You're using kind of technical terms. So can you tell people what you mean when you're saying 501? You know, just because a lot of people may relate that to a nonprofit, right? That may be the first
mm-hmm.
thing people think. So tell them where this policy or regulation came from.
Mm-hmm.
And it's from speaking to you, it's kind of hidden, right? No one knows it's there. So just give, like, briefly, what is this that you're speaking about? It's not non-profit, not for profit. What is it?
Well, I guess where people would get confused when it comes to non-profit, that's 501C, I believe. 501
right. Correct.
C3 or something like that?
Correct.
We focus on 501C, Reg D. And Regulation D really just states that a private company can raise capital in the open market to sell equity or debt in their company without having to register with the SEC. So,
right.
However,
I want to say, if you register with the SEC, that's very expensive, right? So you found a way for people to not have to spend enormous amounts of money to raise capital and still remain privately held, like still have control of their company, correct?
Yes, because registration mostly applies to publicly traded companies who have to file quarterly reports with the SEC to be considered a fully reporting company.
Right, and the SEC, for everyone, is the Securities and Exchange Commission. If you trade on one of the publicly traded, like New York Stock Exchange or a NASDAQ. So some people may be not as smart as you, so I just want to make sure, and there's some really savvy entrepreneurs who will get this the first time, but I want to make sure everyone gets it. So you found a way for companies that are privately held, you have a founder, could be high tech, it doesn't matter what the industry is, they like to keep control. They don't want the limits of crowdfunding, the constraints. And you found this perfect niche where you can help those privately held companies and the founders need growth capital, strategic, whatever it's for. You have an ecosystem, a network, where you can help them do that with this 506, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
In going back to what you said, some people are not as smart as me. Some people are smarter than me. So, I would say that that's the reason why I'm not extensive. I don't have extensive knowledge in crowdfunding. Even though I observe what the requirements are and how it affects companies who are capable to raise capital under that structure, but I have observed that 506C Regulation D is better. And one of the reasons, because it has no minimum and it has no maximum, and it can be continuous. So the way that I was thinking about creating it under our exchange, as if we were looking at creating a entity that's separate from the company that allows their fund to allow them to raise capital separate from the company so that they can always have that arm for either working capital acquisitions or whatever they may need capital for, equipment purchases, et cetera. So they would have an internal financial service or internal bank where they can get capital from, which, you know, their professional accountants can handle how that looks on paper with regards to the terms that they offer, because they can borrow from their own company as a separate entity.
Interesting.
And that's what holding companies usually do anyway. Holding companies usually structure an entity in which holds all the profits so they can reinvest in their portfolio of companies.
What's an example of a popular holding company that people may know of?
Disney, Walt Disney. And I'm glad you asked that, because holding company is a nice model, because there's a difference between the two, a holding and a conglomerate. But since we're talking about holding, Walt Disney is a holding company. And because Walt Disney, the parent company, with all its subsidiaries and spinoffs, they pretty much capitalize on the spinoffs and take the profits and reinvest in each entity that may need capital for whatever reason.
So that means if Disney may have, let's say, $100 billion in cash, and if they have 50 different subsidiaries, like Pixar and whichever ones they have, the holding company infuses capital into that, and they also take the profits from it if they want, correct?
Exactly. They don't.
Okay.
They're not a source of capital. They're not a company that would need to go out to the market and raise capital, even though they're publicly traded. It's good. They probably pay a dividend because they're not raising capital to put back into their company, because if their entities are successful, they don't really have to go and borrow money or raise capital in the open market unless they're doing a movie, or probably they might use it that way. I'm not quite sure what they use there, but I think, you know, them trading in the open market is probably for the benefit of stockholders and pay dividends than to reinfuse capital into their entities, their spin, you know,
right.
their
what
companies
like,
in their portfolio.
Several years ago, they said Apple Computer had more cash than the United States government. Like, I think they had about,
mm-hmm.
what did they have? They had about $100
billion,
dollars, like 70
yeah.
billion.
Yeah.
Right, they had a lot of money. They had more cash than
mm-hmm.
the U.S. government. They had no
mm-hmm.
dividends, but,
mm-hmm.
but so they didn't have to borrow. They didn't need banks. They didn't need, you know, what they traded on the exchange. So Disney is a company that, as they take profits from their subsidiaries, they have a sort of treasure trove of cash. And if one of they're making a new movie or they want to acquire some great new company that's out there that, you know, increases their value proposition, they have the capital, the cash to do that, right? And that's what the whole
yeah.
company does. And
right.
so
and
you're working
what,
with people. Go ahead. And that's what?
No, I was just going to say that's what Google did. They end up creating a venture capital fund, and they started either investing in companies that they saw that might had potential to be unicorns, or they started to acquire companies. Or Apple.
Okay.
You know, they started to either acquire companies or start invest. They created a fund. A lot of those large companies, they have a fund. They do, like, private equity investment
right.
or venture capital.
Okay. So you work with companies to – that's pretty sophisticated. So if you have a client, if they're doing $10 million or $50 million, it doesn't matter – you're going to help them raise, but let's just go with a $50 million company. They need to raise $10 million for growth. They want to expand, and they need to raise $10 million. So obviously crowdfunding has too many constraints. So you help them create a parent company, and that parent company is the one that's raising the capital, and the $10 million they raise sits in the parent company. And then the ABC company is going to borrow from their own parent company. Is that how it works? Or
every deal is case by case, and we try to simplify it. Like, I'm working with a company called 360 Sports. They're a sports agency. Even though in our funding requires, we thought we needed about five or six different documentation. Today, we discovered that sometimes the private placement memorandum is really the only tool you need, because sometimes the deck is good, but the deck is not good to give it to a prospective investor in advance of the PPM. I think sometimes maybe a term sheet or executive summary tells a little bit about the company. So we try to reduce the number, the pages of information that an investor would need to see to make the decision
okay.
to make an investment. However, the private placement offering is the key documentation. So,
okay.
With that being
wait,
said,
I want to stop you there. You said earlier PPM. So just for everyone, in case someone doesn't know, PPM, that's the private placement. What does PPM stand for?
It's private placement memorandum. I like to use the term
good.
Offering
okay.
memorandum, but sometimes I abbreviate
okay.
it and would say PPM.
All right. Just so everyone can stay with you. Right, keep going.
Okay. So you said something. You asked a question about the case, how we would structure it. So I'm the person that has the relationships with institutional investors, and we have a marketing arm, which we call accredited investors, because they verify the accreditation of high net worth individual investors. So there are probably like maybe five or six different licensed professional people, whether they be broker-dealers, CPAs, lawyers. There's a lot of third parties involved in the structure of an offering before it is actually launched to the public. So in 2 weeks, a company can have its term sheet ready and its presentation deck to present to investors in a month. Then they'll have their total offering memorandum to use to actually close deals, because once you have all your legal compliance legal requirements met and compliance requirements met, you can actually self-fund on a daily basis. So anytime an investor, you know, wants to put capital into your company, it's not a 30-day or a two-week closing process. It's the same-day closing process. So that's the benefit of having an offering memorandum, because all the due diligence has been done in advance.
Great, great. So, and I want to say, so you have a, for lack of better words, a pool or a network of institutions and investors that you know who are what you call accredited, because they have a minimum net worth of several million dollars, right? So these are savvy people who are accustomed to doing some kind of investment. Is that correct, the way I'm saying
it? You have two types of investors. You have your sophisticated investors, which are high net worth individuals, and their qualification would probably be husband and wife at $200,000 with $1 million, probably a liquid asset, or
okay.
a combined revenue, a combined income of about $300,000 with $1 million. But the qualified purchasers are any entity. It could be a bank, insurance company, anyone that has more, any entity that has $5 million in assets under management and above.
Okay, good, good. So these are savvy people, and you, part of what you do is you bring these investors together so that they can infuse that capital into the holding company, and then your client is able to borrow from the holding company, which is theirs also, right?
Right, but we don't want to necessarily use the term holding company, because unless the company is a holding company, we can't apply that word to them. They could be a regular S-Corp, C-Corp, LLC. They could be a company. They could be structured in a variety of different ways. Unless they decide to be, because some companies are holding companies and they do acquire companies that are similar to them.
Got it.
Adds value to their bottom line. But some companies can actually raise capital under the same umbrella as the company that they are, unless they're project-based, and then you'll start to change the operating agreement or make the company not necessarily a limited partnership, but will establish a separate entity if that's necessary. So everything is like case by case, you know. There's no standard in which to follow. It's all depends on the details of the specific entity that's looking to raise capital, and how, that's why it says raise capital on your own terms in a way, because we do a brainstorm of what's best for that specific company with regards to the investors on the tax perspective, with regard to the company. You know, there's a lot of different angles of things that we would consider in advance of structuring it.
Okay, and I'll ask one more question, because I want to see what questions Lori has. So
this is way out of my league.
doing this the way you do it. So we talked about crowdfunding, right? So crowdfunding has constraints and limits, right? So you free your clients up from those constraints and limits. On the opposite end of the spectrum, you have venture capitalists, you have banks for loans, and you have private equity. You're not any of those either, correct?
No, we're not, actually. I tell people all the time, especially those who have startup companies and they're looking for $50 million, and there are steps that you have to go through to get to private equity. It's probably the last step, but it's a dangerous position, because private equity would want majority control. So if you're a founder of a company and you need $50 million from a private equity firm, you may lose that foundership position, and you trade places. You'll be a minority, and the capital source would be a majority shareholder of the company. Venture capital wants to sit on the board and wants to be a part of management, because if they invest anywhere between probably maximum $5 million or maybe 10 in some cases, they want to be involved in how that, those funds is allocated. Angel investors, the same thing. Angel investors are necessary, but if you go, if you are looking to raise capital, angel investors are like high net worth individual investors. Having a legal structured document, it's good for the company, because if the company was a superstar potential unicorn, you know, you want to cover your interests legally with transparency that would benefit the investor and the company as well.
Okay. So, and also when you were speaking of private equity, I hear my voice echoing. Someone has the computer on in the background.
That's my phone that I can't figure out how to stop. Ringing.
Oh, okay.
Go ahead.
No, my voice is echoing. That's why.
Do you want to hang up and try and find that in again?
All right, let's just try this. Let's see how this works.
Yeah, no, I think I'm on too.
Okay. So you were saying private equity, they take a majority position.
Yeah, they like to be a majority holder.
It sounds like that could be dangerous, right? So we have a founder out here who's listening and he wants to go to private equity. Does that expose them, once the private equity takes a majority position, is it possible for the founder to either just be like an employee, they're no longer in a CEO position, or they may be relegated to the laboratory, like if they're a tech person, go write code and, you know, we'll run the company, or they could lose the company. Could one of those happen with private equity?
No, private equity lets the founder usually continue to be the founder.
Okay.
A lot of times when a founder becomes an employee, it's because he sold the company and he decided to stay on board for a year or two. That's mostly the case when a founder becomes an employee.
Okay, an earn-out. Could be an earn-out. Doesn't have to be. Yeah. Okay. All right.
Oh, what I was going to say about private equity is what I tell people all the time. Private equity has the most money, and they make the least investments in a year. They even have something called dry powder. It's about $3 trillion in dry powder, and they still make the least investments every year, and that's why the dry powder continues to grow. And the dry powder is money that's add-on or follow-on capital to a company that it's a company may have be in a position for add-on capital. Like they may invest $50 million. If they accomplish their milestone, they may get another $20 million or another $50 million. But if they don't accomplish their milestones, they can't add that capital on. So it just accumulates, and that's why it's at $3
trillion
now.
Wow.
And that's because the money comes from sources like funds of funds, endowments, foundations, pension plans, insurance companies, all the big bucks.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they pension. Yeah. So at some point, they'll have to return that money if they don't use it. But they haven't returned it because the industry is a strange industry. It has a lot of loopholes that are beneficial to the management of funds, which are the private equity firms. Because the broker-dealers, they don't have capital. The private equity firms have capital. And the private equity firms get the relationship. The broker-dealers just brings the companies to the private equity firms. The pension, which are pension plans, insurance companies, funds of funds, and things of that, hedge funds, et cetera, they're the limited partners. They're the ones with all the capital that have to be allocated. They take the teacher's money. They take the fireman's money. They take the police department money. They collectively put all the money together to invest for people's retirement. At least that's what they're under the impressions of, is
right,
that their money is in safe hands and being allocated into companies so that they can have a nice retirement by the time they decide to retire.
Interesting. Are you able to ever get any of that money for your client?
Yes, but that's not the direction that we go into. We only deal with companies are, because if that was the case, we wouldn't really need to do a private offering. And the reason why, because those sources invest under their own terms. So when I'm making a proposal for you to invest under your own terms, you couldn't take this type of instrument to them, and unless their mandate allowed them to do what you call alternative investments, because this is an alternative investment.
Right, right.
It's not the traditional investment, like a private equity or a venture. It's alternative, meaning it's not part of the norm, but it's legal because it's part of the Jobs Act. It was designed in 2008 under the Obama administration, under the Jobs Act. It was a way for small companies to raise capital and provide jobs. That's one thing the Trump administration hasn't dismantled.
Interesting. I don't want to take this in a whole bunch of different directions, but you just made me think of something that maybe it's another an offline with a. I met the former vice chair of NASDAQ, where I had him present at one of my events, and he was part of creating the Jobs Act. So it sounds like he may have had this has his fingerprints on it, because he was concerned with the amount of. Yep, he was concerned about the amount of smaller companies that were doing IPOs when you look historically. So it sounds like he found a way for them to raise capital on their own terms without whatever negative effects was happening in the public market. Interesting.
The only thing it does, because if you've been in the industry of raising capital for companies in the past, they come with their own terms anyway, but they're not structured legally. They're great terms, but if you don't put them in an offering memorandum that protects the investor nationwide, then it's the company's at risk, and so are the promoters, and so are the investors. The investors are sophisticated, so they can. Under Rule 501, sophisticated investors states that they have the wherewithal to withstand loss. So if they invest $150,000 or $500,000 into your company and you didn't do well, it's not going to make or break them. They'll just write that loss off. So that's what Rule 501 is.
Right.
When companies come to me and they have like waterfall type structures and promissory notes and their own convertible note structures, there's no protection there. So the way that we do it, it protects the investor, it protects the company. Because the disclosure and being transparent is everything. And this particular rule, 506C and B, anything under Reg D, it sort of lets the public know that it lets the SEC know that I'm taking money from the public. You know what I mean? So it puts some type of level of integrity for the company.
Right.
Who is actually out there saying, I need this investment. You don't want a person to take the money and go buy a Rolls Royce or $10,000.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? So they'll watch out for stuff like that. Because you have to report to the SEC stating, yeah, we just took our first check. That's it. But it's called Form D. When you first take your first check, then you file Form D. But it's only a sign saying, okay, we're taking money from the public, so we'll be on our best behavior. But if we're not, at least you know who our management people are. Because that's what's on Form D, all the management of the company.
So there is recourse if they display bad behavior and do go out and buy a Rolls Royce.
Well, under 506C, you have something called the bad actor qualification. So not really qualification. I forgot what it's called, but it's a bad actor thing. So you got to do the bad. there's a some level of compliance there. So you have your, when you're doing your due diligence, that's the reason why a broker-dealer is important. They do the due diligence on all the parties involved to make sure they have good reputations. But they're only going to look but so far. I mean, their only concern is if you had bad reputation under their umbrella, the SEC. Have you ever went out into the public before and did this or that? You know what I'm saying? They're not going to go too far back. They're only interested under the rules that they're applying.
Right. Well, just as a side, there's this PPP money. There have been people going out buying Ferraris and other luxury items with it. So.
Mm-hmm. And as soon as they did that, they got arrested. They had a... I read a list of them today on my phone. So they had a whole list. I review them because I some people might think like that and other people will take action. You know, some people are like, I wonder if I did this, would I do get this? And they did it, and they actually end up with cuffs behind their backs, I guess. But like I always said, none of us are employees. So that was the key factor in that whole program. We're all consultants in the firms that I sit on boards of. So and I'm the treasurer of. So we looked at PPP as something that wasn't something that we qualify for as consultants. So we pretty much left that in its own place.
Okay. All right. So, Lori, you're now the fly on the wall.
Great. I'm still here.
Let me ask you, is it just me echoing or is it you also?
No, I'm echoing also.
Okay. All right. So,
yeah, it's not off. Just you. So, for some reason we do echo back. So one of the things I was kind of wondering, I had a few questions in my head. So as more of, I guess, a creative or as a layperson, what exactly is crowdfunding? And then if you were working with a new business, is there a minimum amount that you would take on? Because someone who's starting a business obviously would want all of the financial capital that they could possibly use, but they wouldn't, you know, necessarily have, you know, $5 million, $10 million to, you know, have that company.
Right. That's why they have that's why crowdfunding exists. Crowdfunding more or less exists for the purpose of startup companies to raise capital up to $1 million because they have a process. Outside of crowdfunding, you have friends and family, you have angel investor, you have venture capital, and then you have the private equity. So friends and family, because to take each level of raising capital, if you're doing it the right way, you have legal costs, legal expense. So the way I look at it, friends and family should be covering the legal expense, right? The legal expense could range anywhere between $50,000 to $100,000. And that's where friends and family come in. And because of friends and family, you don't have to have any legal documentation to take capital from your friends and family. However, you will be giving them like stock or whatever type of asset in the company that gives them some form of ownership. And then angel, some companies will go to angel investors because they're out there and they're available. They will appreciate a document that protects their interest in the investment, but it's not necessary. So when it comes to crowdfunding, it's a good tool for startups. We like to stay in the area of companies that have achieved a minimum of $2.5 million in revenue, minimum. And even if the company is a startup, we like companies that at least have assets or some type of intellectual property or real estate. And one of the reasons why is because Even though the investors are sophisticated and can afford a loss, it's always better to mitigate their risk as much as you can. And they'll appreciate that. The more you mitigate their risk and the deal makes sense, the easier it will be for you to raise the capital, and the better the relationship is, will be with the investor.
Right. Right. Mm-hmm. Wow. Wow. Okay. Okay.
So crowdfunding is really not our field.
Uh-huh.
Because we start at $5 million.
Right.
We commit
right.
up to $5 million, but we have investors that will commit up to $10 million, providing that there's synergy between them and the company.
Mm-hmm.
Them and the founders.
Right. How many companies do you work with at a time, or can you work with, you know, up to multiples?
No, we don't overextend ourselves, because at some point, when we're preparing the companies, we got to stop what we're doing and start raising the capital. So this year, we're only looking at committing to 6 companies, and we're at four or five now. We're at like 4 now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So anyone out there?
Yeah.
If they need you, how do they reach you?
786-348-0010, or they can, request a connection on LinkedIn at Valerie Emanuel, VALERIE Emanuel, EMANUEL. I saw you today. When I go online, I'll accept your connection and thank you for it.
Laurie. Yeah, I had to. I couldn't find you, so I had a. I was looking for your email. I was like, oh, I can find you now. I have your name.
Yeah.
I have your TED friend. Good.
Yeah, exactly. LinkedIn is the easiest way. We have the app and the website being developed now for Founders Trust Bank. So in the future,
mm-hmm.
you'll see that on top of the LinkedIn. You'll see it on the LinkedIn. But the terms are on the LinkedIn page.
Mm-hmm.
The terms of the debt or equity capital raise.
Right. I was just going to ask you a question, and it just went out of my head. It was about, like, a new business starting out. And I guess when you started, right, because here you are, what kinds of things were you looking for to start your company, like, as an entrepreneur, as someone who's in finance?
Well, even though I've had several companies that did several different things, but they all were under the finance umbrella. So the one company that's been around for the longest is Valerie Emanuel & Associates. But my company used to be called Marlboro Capital Investment.
Mm-hmm.
But everyone mm-hmm. used to say, you got to meet Valerie Emanuel. So when I moved into a different state, I changed it to Valerie Emanuel & Associates. But when I came to New York, it was just Valerie Emanuel, because I figured that was the brand, because Valerie Emanuel was the one who had the resources or the sources to fund companies. So this company here, this is probably every company that I just mentioned, in a sense, is still existent. But the one that I use the most is Valerie Emanuel & Associates. And that's because all the associates are the sources that actually deliver on the service that Valerie Emanuel offers.
Mm-hmm.
The Founders Trust Bank is the new entity that we developed during the pandemic, because we believe that the world is going digital. So we're like on the same page as Goldman Sachs, because Goldman Sachs created an app called Gemini. And it's for their M&A, their M&A department. So they get to sit at home, work remotely, and look on the app for opportunity through Goldman Sachs. And it's called Gemini, one easy word. And we couldn't think of an easy word, just one word so far.
Mm-hmm.
But someone gave me a business, because I work with businesses all the time, and they hear what we're doing for the 21st century, and they created a company called Founders Trust advisors, and they acquire a lot of companies, and they have a lot of employees. They have jobs under that business plan, and they're all called relationship managers. And they said, here, you can have this, and maybe we can work together with this. This is a good idea. Tell me what you think. So I like the idea. It's a whole different concept, but it does, it would be like if we were to buy a business, that one would be one we would acquire. So that's how we came up with the Founders Trust Bank, from the Founders Trust entity. And so it's really a compilation of any of everything I've ever done in the business, because you can finance any type of project. You can do real estate. I started in real estate, you know. So you can finance anything under that umbrella. So it's really a compilation of everything I've ever done in my life with the right team.
Yeah, I guess it all comes down to the right team, right?
Yes. You got to have
that. As they say, hire people smarter than you or with different skills than you.
That's right. Because, you know, when, say, for example, if it's a real professional group of people that can work together, because I used to work for AT&T when I was a kid, and one of the things I saw in working for a big corporation was everybody does a little bit to make a whole. You know, we had, AT&T had so many different departments. It used to be like with IBM, one of the largest employers in the country, hundreds of thousands of employees. So, but everybody did a little piece of a big thing. They did a little piece of the accounting department. They did a little piece of the marketing department. But there were so many different people that handled a small piece of the whole. So in creating a company and understanding that your role is this role and my role is this role, and we all put our roles together to complete one specific objective, that's really like the bottom line of being having a successful business. And one of the businesses that's easy to put together, because I've done this before, is you when you put a team together, because I think that my original company many years ago, because I've been self-employed for over 30 years, and one of the companies was called the Bank of Financial Services, which is BANC. The Bank of Financial Services was a real estate-based company. So you would have your own title company. You have someone specialized in title work. You have someone specialized in mortgages. You have someone specialized in real estate. You have lawyers. You have closing agents. You know, you had everybody that handled different aspects of a deal and to close it, multiples at one time. So it was always good to have those sectors, even if as a small company, to have those divisions and departments that handle other things just to complete the whole process, to fulfill a bigger picture.
Okay, very cool. So, Valerie, let me ask you, if someone's out there and they are thinking about contacting you, how will they know if they're qualified? So one of the things you said was $2.5 million in revenues, and then you started talking about startups. So what's your criteria for someone to qualify for this investment program?
I have so many pages on this desk that I'm surprised that when I got on the call, the main paper is not on my desk no more. But in the, let's see, the criteria, as I mentioned a moment ago, the criteria is usually companies who have earned upwards of $2.5 million in revenue. And right. One of the reasons why is because we like to mitigate the risk to the investor. So if they were a startup, I'll give you an example. There's a company called NoWin. NoWin is a medical device that lets women know when they're ovulating in case they want to make a baby. And sometimes the people who actually buy that device are men. But when I had was given the task to raise capital for it, I was kind of embarrassed to sell that to men, the ideal of it to men, because they just, it's just not something that you can talk about with men because they don't get it sometimes, I guess, and not to insult any men, even though men were
right.
buying the product. But it right. was kind of hard to sell that ideal to men because only women can relate to that, ovulation.
Okay.
So
right.
This is what I say. She was publicly traded at one time, and she was actually she was going public on the OTC markets. She had revenue and she had investors. But when P&G decided they wanted to buy her patents and buy her company, she wasted a lot of time negotiating with P&G. So she has a lot of patents that she was trying to protect. So she had to go through a legal battle with P&G, which is a big company. And I think they
right.
were associated with Johnson & Johnson and Palmolive and all those big companies that have those type of device medical products. So I said to her, I used to work with a company called QuarterSlim. And QuarterSlim did what they call direct TV marketing or something like direct TV response marketing or something like that. And they would do infomercials in the middle of the night and have a toll-free number and tell the people you can lose weight in 30 days. You could take the strength, the medium mile, or the regular. And they were selling this QuarterSlim product. And this QuarterSlim product, you could go to Walgreens, CVS, Kmart, Walmart, and buy this product because I've had it myself. So what happened was the FCC said, oh, they made $260 million in 1 year just on direct TV response. So because her and I was on the phone, I said, well, if you don't have revenue, then what we need to do is put in the offer memorandum that you need to raise capital to do an infomercial. So we'd look up, you know, what is the best company. I think it was TVA or something like that, marketing company. Media, TVA Media, and we say, okay, let's see how much it's going to cost so that you can put in this invoice in the exhibits so they'll know where $1 million is going to be allocated to. Because $1 million was what it cost to do an infomercial for 9 months, 6 to 9 months. But you can make money off it. So doing that infomercial, they would have been calling the 800. Any woman is up at night, and she's surfing in there, and she's like, oh, I'm trying to make a baby, and I just can't make it. And then she gets the ovulation tool. Then she can pay attention to her ovulation, and maybe she'll succeed. So I also said, well, where is all your inventory now? Because she's like, well, do you think the inventory would be, do you think we can finance using the inventory? No, because most of the companies only finance when you're acquiring inventory. Most of the investors or lenders, they finance when you're acquiring inventory. They don't finance on the inventory you already have, because if you have inventory, that means you're not selling your product. So why would they lean on your inventory if you're not using it to make money?
Right.
So I told her, let's put in an exhibit the invoice for the infomercial, which is probably about $1 million. And if you needed to go longer for 12 months, it would be about $2 million because the minimum investment is $5 million. So I said, then this is what we can do since you're a startup. Why don't you look for a building? We'll put a piece of real estate in there, a warehouse. So when you manufacture your inventory, you have a place not only to operate from, but you also have a place to store your inventory because you're renting, 1,000 square feet now and paying rent on a building that's holding your inventory. So go get your own building and have an office in there. Maybe you have some tenants in there. So you'll have a good, strong investment. So when we present it to an investor, he says, aha, this looks like a good deal, and I got some assets in there that I can protect my money, because at the end of the day, I like the zero coupon convertible note. And the zero coupon convertible note, that means I have a bond for, say I'm selling it for $1,000, but you get to buy it for $8. So how does that bond for a startup company have any value? Because it's secured by the assets within the company. So if the company went bankrupt, you just liquidate the assets and you pay the investors back their principal. Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Perfect. Any thoughts, Lori?
Yeah. Lori? No, I was just going to say we have 5 minutes left.
5 minutes left.
So I really want to thank Valerie for her immense knowledge, explanation, and for being our guest.
Oh, thank you, Lori. I appreciate that. I never know how good I do, but this is what I know for sure. And Ted probably knows it too. When I get on the phone, I'm a, I don't know what you call them people who talk a lot anyway. And I think sometimes the more you talk, the better you can communicate. And that's why when I wake up in the morning, you know, the word repetition always comes to mind. Repetition is everything. You have to make a habit in doing what you're doing. The more you do it, the better you get. So enjoy your repetition every day. Find a way to repeat everything you do. Because I narrowed down my 13-page presentation to 2 pages. And that way, that's easy to repeat every day.
Right. So
yeah.
with the last couple of minutes, what are your final words of wisdom for people who are listening?
I just gave it to you, the repetition.
Repetition.
What do you want me to do? Open up the scriptures and tell you, give you a prayer?
No, your final words of wisdom for what
you
do. You know, if they're looking to raise capital.
Repetition. That came to me naturally, but now I got to think of something that's not going to come out naturally. When repetition was the gift that I gave a person, but I was telling somebody they didn't know, right? I was probably telling them something they didn't know. But this is what I want to say. If you want some words of wisdom, the month of September is right around the corner. Try not to sleep with your phone. Put it in a different room. Turn off all your devices. Get a good night's sleep. Don't watch no news and swipe right all day long on your phone. Don't take the time to read none of that garbage. How about that? I swipe right all day long.
Because
it's going to swipe right. Swipe right. Yeah. Swipe right all day long.
I love that. That's great.
Yeah, September.
Right.
Make that commitment that 30 days. Discipline yourself not to see anything because you're going to be distracted 100%. And it's not that serious out there. It appears to be, but it's really not.
Right.
They want
there,
you to think that way, but it's really not.
There are more important things to accomplish than getting caught up with all the distractions.
Yeah, because I was on the phone with these guys today that are investment bankers, and they said they were from California, and they were talking about being in front of a wave and pushing back on the wave, but they said, let's ride this wave. And I like that idea. Instead of pushing back from the wave, let's ride it. Because it's going somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Ride the
Perfect.
Wave.
Perfect.
Yeah.
So in the face of this global pandemic, that's a pretty good last word. Ride the wave. Don't push it back.
Yeah.
There's going to be something there for everyone. So
that's right.
Those are great words. So I'm going to thank you for accepting my invitation again. Always
thank
a pleasure
you.
Speaking to you. And thank you. And I can only imagine the knowledge that people have gained by listening to you. So thank you for being so generous with your time and sharing so openly. So give people once again how they can contact you. How can they get a hold of you?
Okay, my name is Valerie Emanuel, and Emanuel is spelled with one M, Emanuel. Valerie is Valerie. The easiest way is just to look me up on LinkedIn. And my number directly is 786-348-0010. That's a landline. So don't worry about I should give you my mobile if you want to text me in advance. But I think we'll stick with the landline for now. 786-348-0010.
Perfect. Good. Good. Lori, any last words?
No, thank you so much.
Before we sign out here.
It was a pleasure having
you.
And
you said it twice.
Thank you for being so knowledgeable.
Oh, thank you, Lori. I appreciate that. And thank you for inviting me. both of you guys, Ted and Lori, I appreciate the invitation. I appreciate the opportunity to practice.
Yeah,
all right. Our pleasure. And this is recorded in case you want to send it to anyone. So you can
send me a copy. Okay, perfect.
All right, perfect.
I like it. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you.
Everyone, have a good evening, and we'll talk to you soon. We'll be back next week with another guest. Take care, and good night, everyone. Goodbye.
All right, good night. Thank you.
Good night.
Good night. Good night, Laura. Bye-bye. Good night, Ted.